Hello, friends. We are now in Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 153A. We are continuing with some very, I think, difficult stanzas from Cosmic Fire that relate to astronomical and astrological factors. There was a paragraph about three different types of solar angels, and it was difficult to tell what the antecedents were. We talked about the Uranus, Neptune, and Saturn scheme, and then that the Agnishvatas functioning there function differently from those in, here's a mixture of sacred and non-sacred planets, Venus, Vulcan, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Earth, and the exoteric Saturn scheme, as do the monastic devas of the inner round. Okay. So they are the second to be mentioned. And I suspect that when we get down to the point where we are talking about having a triplicity of groups, we have a triplicity of groups of planets, that is, the synthesizing planets, the ones that were mentioned above, and also the planets of the inner round, or whatever the inner round really means. So there's the triplicity of forces in the others, and namely, this is the highest planets, I believe. I didn't get that before, but now I think so. The synthesizing planets, the higher group of Agnishvatas, and the middle group of Agnishvatas. See, the higher group are connected with the monastic permanent atom, and they make adjustments in the egoic group of egoic lotuses. And the middle group deals with the nine petals particularly, that the higher group and the middle group hold sway in the highest of all the planets. And because they are the most occult and sacred in manifestation, they're concerned with egos on the path, and therefore with group activity, in connection with Uranus, Neptune, and Saturn. This might be expected. So the word others seems to refer to the highest group of planets, the synthesizing planets. See, it's an antecedent like this, which is difficult to decipher. There are so many things to which it might refer. This might be expected, as they are the synthesizing planets, planetary schemes, and provide conditions suitable only for the very advanced stages, and they are called the reaping planets. It may be that others also refers to some of the sacred planets as well that are not synthesizing planets. This would have to be worked out, but certainly on Uranus, Neptune, and Saturn, only very advanced egos are found there, and so the higher and middle group of Agnishvatas, and not the lowest group of Agnishvatas, which has more to do with the personality expression, only the higher two groups would hold sway, I think, is what we're being told. This is of course, the disadvantage of taking these excised paragraphs out of context, because we don't have the entire reading of what went before. So maybe that will clarify the issue just a little bit for those who want to get more deeply into the study. We're told in number 26 that Mercury, Venus, the Sun, and Moon constitute the guardian angels of the four corners of the Earth. And I was thinking of a section in Externalization of the Hierarchy, page 116 and 17, where we have the names of the Lords of Karma, and what they signify symbolically and from the angle of their inner meaning, relationship, enlightenment, pain, and return. Ponder on this, and they are all peculiarly active at this time, and in their activity lies the hope of humanity. Now, I noticed that when these Lords of Karma are actually, I believe, planetary logoi. Let's see if we can go to that section here. Yes, this is an externalization of the hierarchy, right? Okay. The Lord of Pain has descended from his throne. Okay, and then there also is the restimulation of the instinct to self-preservation, which in its highest aspect is the instinct to immortality, and it tends to focus humanity's attention upon the life aspect and not upon the form. So the names of the Lords of Karma signify, symbolically and from the angle of their inner meaning, relationship, enlightenment, pain, and return. Maybe we would find a connection between these four as listed and the names of the inner meanings of the Lords of Karma. At least two of them suggest relationship, Venus, Mercury, enlightenment. When it comes to return, what could be the meaning? Return of the prodigal son. To the soul and life aspect. Possibly that. But he elaborates on that a little bit more, and he says, the sun and the moon veil hidden planets. Now, again, written before Pluto was discovered. These are the four Maharajas connected with karma. So planetary lords can be considered as Maharajas, connected with karma, humanity, cosmos, and man. The usual four Maharajas are greater beings. But when he starts to mention these following names, the sun, or Michael, or its substitute, Michael, and thus associated, I think, with Leo, the moon, or Gabriel, I believe associated with Scorpio, and Mercury and its substitute Raphael. This is to be associated, I believe, with Aquarius, and Mercury has a close connection with Aquarius and with the cosmic ethers, which over which Aquarius, Uranus, and Mercury, I think, preside. And Venus, as the ruler of Taurus, and Venus, this is usually considered to be Taurus. So I'll put these down as at least these speculative titles. Gabriel is Scorpio. Although you kind of think that Gabriel should be connected with hierarchical Mercury, since he is the one who announces. There are different assignments of the archangels, but usually they are connected with planetary logoi, and this is Leo. So Maharajas is also one of these protean terms, a flexible, mutable term, and can relate to different orders of beings. Maharajas take their place at the four corners of our solar system in a way these planets do not. So perhaps we can think of the Maharajas as still greater beings connected with the three Lipika lords from Sirius, who administer all that is transpiring karmically in our solar system. But now, hidden planets. This is a note. Let's turn to 646 in esoteric astrology and see in what manner this is presented. And this may be a secret doctrine note. It looks like it, because I remember this discussion of the sun and its substitute. I don't think that we can locate these in esoteric astrology or cosmic fire as belonging to some other book than the Secret Doctrine. I think only one reference, and that is, yes, this is the Secret Doctrine. And we don't know whether the sentences in the secret doctrine are exactly what they are here, or whether this is the information gleaned from the secret doctrine. So we have possibly hidden planets, but I would tend to think that when we're dealing with pain and return, if we want to find a substitute for pain and return, we might say that the sun veils Vulcan, a hidden planet, and that the moon veils Pluto, another hidden planet. I have seen some derivations of the glyph of Pluto which seem based upon the moon. And the connection between the moon and the astral plane and Pluto in the astral plane is pretty clear. Now, when we're dealing with four lords of karma, whose names are... that's not what I want. The four lords have names of relationship, enlightenment, pain, and return. There are different ways of looking at this, but I think it's pretty clear that relationship and enlightenment are related respectively to Venus and to Mercury. Definitely a planet of enlightenment, conferring sight to the blind. So, yes, a planet of enlightenment. And then when it comes to pain, I think the best candidates are either, you know, Pluto, which was hidden at that time. Oh, how about, all right, and return, which could be considered, in a way, Vulcan. A return to the sun, self, Leo. The sun is often the ruler of Vulcan. It is a planet which promotes illumination, but also the spiritual will to return. Now, when I look at pain, I think Saturn would be a very good candidate for pain. It is a definitely karmic planet, but it is not a hidden planet. And we're told that the sun and moon veil hidden planets. Now, if this is from the secret doctrine, well and good, and at that time both Vulcan and Pluto were hidden, but now there's only one of those hidden planets. There's also a sun and moon veiling two planets, which are non-sacred and are not given names. I don't think either one of these is Sigma per se. So the sun and moon veil hidden planets in the days of the secret doctrine. Vulcan and Pluto, two first-rate planets, pain and return. See, Vulcan gives us the sense, Vulcan gives the sense of the immortality of the being, a planet of great will and persistence. And Pluto, of course, can be associated with pain because in the elimination process, a type of cleansing and disintegration of less valuable or even substances that are irritating and do not belong, that elimination is taken. An ejection from your system is often a very wretched experience, as we know. I mean, when people throw up, they're not very happy, are they? So, let's just say Pluto can rule a wretched ejection from the system, which is always painful. So are we dealing here with lords of karma? Pluto has made its esoteric approach to the earth, or is making that. The guardian angels of the four corners of the earth, and then in a way one is death. And DK talks about death and pain in this section of the externalization, where it's externalization is found here. Okay. So dying and the painful process of it. It looks to me like dying and pain are going together. Pain has always been a purifying agent, that's Plutonian, employed by the lords of destiny to bring about liberation. The accumulated pain of the present war and the inherited pain of the earlier stage begun in 1914, so this was written during the Second World War, is bringing about a salutary and changing world consciousness. The Lord of Pain has descended from his throne, and is Pluto on his jet-black throne, perhaps? And is bringing distress, agony, terror to those who cannot interpret his ends, but bringing about also a re-stimulation of the instinct to self-preservation, which in a higher aspect is the instinct to immortality. And there is where Pluto may give over to Vulcan with this tremendous sense of the persistence of the immortal spirit and the being. So when it says the Lord of Pain has descended from his throne, I do think about Pluto on his jet black throne, as it is called. The Lord of Pain has descended from his throne, and are we dealing with Pluto on his jet black throne? So definitely pain and dying are mentioned in one breath, mentioned together in this section. These are the four Maharajas connected with karma, humanity, cosmos, and man. Now, it's hard to believe that Saturn would be left out, but of course, Saturn is not a hidden planet, so we have to understand that we are dealing with two hidden planets, hidden at the time. Uriel of the archangels is usually associated with the ox, and hence with Venus as the ruler of Taurus. Well, this is problematic. Michael is associated with the sun. No problem there. But the and with Leo. But the rulership here, Gabriel, is usually Mercury the Annunciator, and that would be the hierarchical ruler of Scorpio. Why should the moon be included at all? Anyway, Mercury is connected in this assignment of rulerships with Raphael, which is the connected with Aquarius. Now, we remember there's always a connection of Gabriel with Scorpio. We remember that picture of the cross, which is really a six-pointed star, and there is a triangle connecting Scorpio at the topmost point, and presumably Taurus at the bottom with Leo at the side. Anyway, a triangle is created with Enoch, the type of the Aquarian man, in the very center. We have to see whether Raphael and Enoch are to be connected. Are Raphael and Enoch to be connected? Well, you can see what a tremendous learning AAB had. Although she's a first-ray soul, what would be her monadic ray? She has a tremendous accumulation of knowledge, also fed by the Tibetan. And maybe it was, I think, the Tibetan's third-ray monad which allowed him to work so closely, informationally, with AAB. So she, I mean, with HBB, so she could take what he gave him and write it up in her own form. With AAB, the relationship was different, I think, and on the basis of the soul ray, and there was a much more faithful taking down, thought by thought, word for word, in some cases, than in the case of HBB, who took the information and wrote it up in her own way. Sometimes you feel the tremendous intelligence, liberating intelligence behind HBB. The right use of the mind can bring liberation. This we know, and this the Buddha showed. In her own way, HBB seems to be doing the same thing, even though her soul would be on the first ray. Her connection with Master R was very deep, as Cagliostro apparently, and he was initiated into was initiated into Master R's lodge as the Count of Saint-Germain at that time. So there is a very close connection between the soul that is HBB and the Tibetan and Master R, and also in a very deep sense with Master M and KH, although perhaps the delivery of many items of information was made by Master DK. Well, there are many things to correlate in the secret doctrine with what the Tibetan has said. Now, here are some really strange things, some of this. Saturn, the devotional faculties, governs the devotional faculties. Well, we wouldn't think so. Not according to the rays, we would not think so. So why, what mystery is here? The rays do not give this. But Saturn governs the bridge to the egoic lotus, and also the greater bridge from the previous solar system to the present solar system, and salvation for many who at the time had clung to the mother, we are told, was given by Saturn. So is there something, the rays of Saturn seem to be all on the hard line, and the planets, or the signs that it rules, have many hard line rays as well. Capricorn has all hard line rays, and maybe even the fifth ray to be added. At times it seems so. Libra has only the third ray, another hard line ray, but the third ray is kind of a swing ray, in a way, between the hard line and the soft line. But there is a great conformity to the archetype in Saturn. A great conformity to the archetype is found in Saturn, and can we call this devotion? Normally we would think that Mars or Neptune rule the devotional faculties, but the adherence to the archetype of which Saturn gives can be considered devotion. But other than that, why HBB should have said this, of course there is a certain adhering loyalty in Saturn. A kind of relentless karmic commitment. There is that. Mercury governs the intellectual faculties. Clear enough, it seems to be a fifth ray monad, and maybe ultimately a third ray monad, given that it is perhaps the most strictly intellectual of the planets. And the Buddha who has the third ray monad is called, is associated with Mercury, and the word Buddha also means Mercury, and his present function coming from Shambhala at the time of the Vaisak festival means Mercury. It is a Mercurian function of intermediaryship. Interesting HPB's perspective on these things. A little different angle than the Tibetan, but intellectual seems reasonable enough. A fifth ray, third ray monad with the third ray. Now, how do I get that? There must be a way. TDR. Yep, that's all it is. With the third ray being the highest of the monadic rays, the major one. Okay. Jupiter governs the sympathetic faculties. Well, a second ray soul. Second ray soul. And associated with, you know, the ruler of the sign Pisces, compassion, and associated with Bodhi, one of the rulers of the Buddhic plane. And associated also with the expansion of consciousness and associated with inclusion. And so when you take in, as it were, the condition of others, this is the prelude to sympathy. So when you include others in your ring pass knot, you have sympathy because their feelings are now within your feelings, in a way. Things are not happening to others, but to yourself, because you have included the states of others within yourself, i.e. within your ring pass knot. Okay. That's possible. The sun governs the governing faculties, and, you know, behind it, let's look for Vulcan and the men of will, as DK talks about them, who wield governance. Mars, clearly enough, well, the sun is certainly the central factor in our solar system and the great leader of all the planetary host. The sun is the hyparxis, the height of any hierarchy, the height of our solar systemic hierarchy. But Vulcan, of course, is often substituted for the sun, and Uranus is substituted for the sun as well. Uranus too. Whoop, don't want that. Uranus too can be substituted for the sun. So Uranus has this great control, inner control, and I suppose outer control. It is a planet of governance. It has a first ray monad. When it comes to Mars, the selfish faculties, no question about it, at the second initiation, Mars is overcome by Vulcan, the will, and a great blow at selfishness is struck. So Mars is the personality. Mars is the entire elemental life. So is the moon. Mars rules every elemental in the personality, and also the personality elemental itself. And these are overcome, ending the ancient authority of the personality. And I suppose especially at the third degree is Mars overcome. Mars is overcome. And then the individual is influenced by the Sirian energy and is definitely and irrevocably on the path and cannot take the left-hand path anymore. Failures may loom ahead of certain kinds, but never a great deviation from the plan of the solar logos or of the planetary logos. This is interesting. Let's just go to the moon first, and we say, yes, of course. Everything rooted in matter, the tendencies of matter towards its own fulfillment are known as instincts. And the moon represents the dense, moon represents the dense physical form. So all of the subconscious promptings, which have their own purpose, which are not necessarily the purpose of the indwelling life, so the subconscious that should be subconscious, shouldn't it? That should definitely be subconscious. SB, CNS. And I should have had that. Subconscious. SCIOUS. Okay. All of the subconscious promptings leading to the preservation or gratification of the form are rooted in matter, which the moon symbolizes. Okay. Now, Venus and the tenacious faculties. These are unusual words. Tenacity, well, you would think of Vulcan, persisting throughout the gestation period. Or you might think of the moon and Cancer. The sign Cancer seems to prompt human beings to hold on to conditions. You might even think of Saturn. If he had said that Venus governs the devotional faculties, I would have said, yes, it's got a six-ray monad and is highly magnetic. But let's call it like this. Magnetic faculties, which will not release until consummation. So we might say that the magnetism of Venus, the magnetism of love shows no respite, no let up, as the Tibetan has described the second ray. So in its magnetism, in its loving magnetism, it shows tenacity. Perhaps that's the way we can understand that particular assignment, those ideas. So some very different ones are here from HBB. And, you know, I suppose in conversation with her, we could understand what she was driving at. The seven angels who preside over the seven planets are the builders of the universe. Well, let's be careful about how we define universe. In those days, the view of the universe was very different from what it is at this time. So, you know, what is a universe? Space had not been explored in the same way. The galaxies had not been located, although these island universes were probably known to the initiate. The term universe is oftentimes meant as our solar system, a strange deflation of the word, in a way, collapsing of the word. The term universe often means our solar system. They are the natural guardians of the seven regions of our planetary system. Well, what are regions? I mean, in a way, we have to ask that, you know, what are the regions? And let's see. The regions are the seven chains or the seven globes. And regions mean localization in a way. All of the different continents and the different centers on the globe, they all correspond to these septenates, so they can all be considered to be regions. But when we're talking about our planetary system, it is a sevenfold system, and there are chains. Each one of the chains is definitely ruled by one of the planets. Now, what is interesting here, this tells us of the, let's call it archangel ship, strange word, angel ship of the planetary logoi. HPB calls them angels, and Saturn is considered, for instance, the archangel Michael. So the idea that planetary logoi are really archangels is advanced in the secret doctrine. This idea is advanced, and we see the seven angels who preside over the seven planets. We might as well have said the seven planetary logoi who preside over the seven planets. So, in sum, angels and planetary logoi in this context are equivalent. The seven builders, this is an interesting one. How it is done would be hard to say, but the seven builders graft the divine and beneficent forces onto the gross material of the vegetable and mineral kingdoms every second round. Well, the second round, the second round has to do with the coming of the second aspect of divinity. And the, quote, beneficent forces are part of that second aspect of divinity. Jupiter, the planet of beneficence, is at this time primarily expressing the second ray. So there must be, in the second round, a great augmentation, refinement, elevation of these kingdoms through the beneficent forces. In the second round, these kingdoms must receive quite an energy conferral, which raises their quality and speeds them along their evolution. The second round is that round in which the great laws, who I think are solar angels, looked in on the process that was to eventually make the human being, and they determined that there was no readiness yet. Things had not advanced far enough for them to do their work, the developmental process. There was also the miscreation, which I suspect came under the ignorant planetary spirits. And this, I think, took place more in the fourth round, where the remnants of the third round animals were recombined into forms which were supposed to be the vehicles for the race of human beings. That was not possible. There is such a connection between the solar angels, the reptile kingdom, or let's just say the serpents of fire from a higher perspective, and the second ray, and beneficence. If we're talking about beneficent forces, the grafting would definitely relate to the descent of beneficent forces, but a different kind of grafting occurred in the fourth round. If interesting, this is a sort of a botanical term. You combine two plants, you graft one onto another, and the whole continues to grow. A different kind of grafting in the fourth round, when the solar angels shot forth from the bow, as it were. This is the individualization process. And the solar angelic essence was grafted onto the animal man of the period, having pervaded the entire universe with a fraction of myself, I remain. So that fraction of the solar angel was grafted grafted into the mechanism of the animal man, allowing a much more rapid growth. So there must be an analogy here, and an analogy must be present about the better advancement between or concerning the two types of graftings. Improvement in the vegetable kingdom and even mineral kingdom, and later through the coming of the beneficent forces, the improvement in the condition of animal man so he could enter the fourth kingdom of nature. Well, you know, a little thought, a little statement goes a long way towards suggesting possibilities. This word graft, meaning to take a portion of something of a transformative nature and combine it with the life process of a lesser being. Generally, the grafts are meant to improve the condition of the lesser being. So those who are individualized on the earth chain are presently expressing a stage of evolution which is a result of a grafting of solar angelic essence into their nature. A grafting of solar angelic essence into their nature. Those who are members of, members of Earth humanity, of Earth humanity. Okay. The seven planetary spirits or angels, she does it again, right, are identical with the Daihan Chohans of esoteric doctrine. This is so important. What an important equivalence. Planetary spirits, well, let's write the equivalence right down there. It's like this. Equivalence. UV, EQVC. So, planetary spirits, angels, Daihan Chohans, Archangels, spirits of the presence, Christian terminology. The truth abides, and the structures created by the deity or emanated by the deity abide, but different cultures, civilizations, and religious movements rename these ongoing structural factors according to their own design. So Diane Chauhan, you see, we can look at all of these as having kind of an intraplanetary correspondence, lower correspondence. The solar angels are Diane Chauhan's, and I suppose are spirits of a planetary presence and so forth. Whatever we have here on a systemic level, that's what we're talking. We're talking a systemic level here. We have also, in an intraplanetary sense, intraplanetary level as well. And when studying the secret doctrine, always the question is, what level am I dealing with? Am I dealing with something that is totally cosmic and has to do with the entirety of cosmos? Am I dealing within my solar system? Am I dealing within my planet? And sometimes HPB switches contexts on us. The Tibetan also does this. And the switching of contexts is also a means of blinding. What an extraordinary wariness it must take on the part of these great teachers to sense what could be gathered and learned from the knowledge revealed, and whether that type of acquisition is in line with the plan or not. So there's an instantaneous kind of realization, maybe coming from attunement with the still higher initiates and even Sanatkumara, about what can be permitted, what can be revealed. It's not just the statement, it's the implications of the statement and what the statement may cause when received or assimilated by the unready. So people who are not into the esoteric worldview are very frustrated by what they consider to be a confusion of terms, not realizing that the teachers are speaking to those who have the eyes and ears to penetrate the terms, but they are definitely veiling their information through blinding from those who do not have the eyes and ears, and thus from those who are not permitted yet to see. The seven chief deities are the rays of the one boundless unity. Well, if we are talking about the Prajapatis, then we are working in an intra-systemic manner. The one boundless unity is utterly universal. Okay. In scope. Now, we could say that the universal logos is the one boundless unity, but the word boundless contradicts this. If we have boundlessness, we can't have a one. We can only have a zero, in a way. Or we can have nothing finite, and in a system of recurring universes, you cannot have recurring universes which are infinite, otherwise the time processes within them would not allow recurrence. So, we might have to consider the one boundless unity as the boundless immutable principle. The boundless immutable principle. And then, what are the chief deities? The chief deities cannot be planetary. They have to be almost ultra-cosmic, the original Septonate of, well, I call them number gods. So, again, you know, HBB switches context on us. It's talking about planets. But then she goes to the chief deities, which of course has a planetary correspondence, but at the same time, it can represent, it can be a point to a universal context. When I use the word universe, I do mean the grand totality, the grand entirety. Earlier, the word universe may have referred only to our particular solar system, but I try to look for the being who is the one of our entire universe, including all of the various dimensions which people sometimes call other universes. We have to be so careful about the way a term is actually used and the thoughts that it connects with. So the universal logos, the one logos of all the universe, but not the same as the one boundless unity, nor the boundless immutable principle, nor the absolute, nor any of these other names which we give to that which really cannot be named. Each of the seven chambers of the pyramid was known by the name of one of the planets. Well, this is an amazing thought. So pyramids were initiation chambers, or, well, initiation almost temples. And to be an initiate, one must assimilate the gifts of the planetary septonate. I mean, not all at once, of course. The different initiations seem to be ruled by different planets or have them associated with them. The initiations have certain planets associated with them and certain zodiacal constellations. It doesn't happen all at once, but probably different chambers were involved in different types of initiations. Some people study the Egyptian mythology. It's a lifelong study, and it's considered, I think, a very legitimate study. So I don't know what the seven chambers are. One usually hears of the king's chamber, for instance, and the queen's chamber, and so forth. I really don't know what are the names, but the idea that there should be a septonate of areas within the pyramid where different kinds of rites and conferrals are occurring makes sense to me. This is, in a way, the precursor of modern masonry, and through the initiations therein, energies needed for the rounded out individual are conferred upon the candidate. To be a candidate is to undergo trials and tests, but also great receptions. The Kabiri were always the seven planets who, together with their father, the sun, composed a powerful Agdod, which is the eight-sided figure. I suppose, well, this is kind of like an octahedron, I would suspect. It has six vertices and eight sides. So the Kabiri are like the Prajapati. How is it pronounced? Prajapati? Prajapati? The emphasis on the syllable, you know, one would have to know that. But as we look at that from our English perspective, it looks like more like Prajapati. So again, we have Martanda and his seven brothers. Okay. The ancients knew of seven planets beside the sun, the seventh with two others were mystery planets. Now, how are we going to look at this? These were the ancients. Vulcan was not discovered, nor was Uranus and Neptune. Discovered really in the 20th century, so one can see how the mysteries are emerging. 19th century, rather. Well, really, let's do it right. 18th century for Uranus and 19th century for Neptune and 20th century for Pluto. The heavenly one, that was a mystery planet. It was Uranus. Vulcan has made his way into mythology, and so... but we would have nine, we would have nine planets, and with Vulcan there are always 10. So maybe Vulcan was not included here. Maybe the Sun, Vulcan are considered a unit. Definitely Uranus was mentioned as a mystery planet, the heavenly planet. And he's even now known as the Heavenly One. So what do we have? We have Mercury, visible at times, Venus, visible. Earth, we live on it, Mars, visible, Saturn, visible. That is five. We can't see beyond, Jupiter. So let's start again. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, that is six. And I suppose the moon would have been considered a planet, which would have made seven. And that's all that's visible. The sun is the center. Now, the seventh with two others were mystery planets. The other possibility here is that Vulcan is the mystery planet and Pluto was not considered. And then Uranus and Neptune were added as mystery planets. So if Pluto was not considered, although he did appear in the Egyptian mythology, and maybe as Anubis, and maybe other mythologies as well. I mean, obviously the initiates know the names of these beings, as well as the names of many, many undiscovered beings that even now remain undiscovered. If Pluto's not considered, then the three mystery planets would be Vulcan, Uranus, and Neptune. And that seems fair enough. Pluto was way beyond the possibility of discovery. And the seventh planet, you know, what could that be? I mean, if you think we really only have... What could be... what could be this seventh planet? Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, that gives us six. We have to have a seventh. We cannot have seen the planets beyond. So Uranus and Neptune are definitely mystery planets. Poseidon and Uranus. And then we have to have one other. It's either what could be the seventh? Well, the seventh intra-Saturnian planet, Saturn was definitely visible, would have been Vulcan, but it would be undiscovered. So if the word seven means intra-Saturnian, we must include Vulcan. If the seven suggests an intra-Saturnian state, then Vulcan must be included. Pluto would be left out. Now we have 10 planets and only 9 are here listed. Well, I think we are at that point. We can say then that this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 153A. And we're on page 647. I guess there's such a heavy dose of cosmic fire in this section that the going is not particularly easy or speedy. I think I took 5 years to do the commentaries on cosmic fire. And that was most of the book, 5 years. It's a long time. Just a drop in the bucket when it comes to the type of wisdom we're dealing with here. And so I know how much thought it took to ponder over some of these more cosmic statements made in Cosmic Fire. And we are being presented with them here. And I am trying to look for an overview which can make discussion of them meaningful. Definitely Uranus is one of the mystery planets. It says the ancients had their mystery planet, and this was Uranus. Now, Neptune is said not even to belong to our solar system, and yet it is one of the synthesizing planets. What does that mean, that it doesn't belong to our solar system? I think for the other one of the mystery planets, we will have to choose between Pluto and Neptune and Vulcan. This is if the moon is considered. If the moon is not considered, then with Vulcan, a mystery planet, we have, counting outward, inward from Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Earth, Venus, Mercury, Vulcan. That's seven. Then Vulcan will have to be that planet, and then we look at the three Saturnian planets, and Uranus and Neptune are listed in our charts, cosmic fire charts. Interestingly, Pluto is not. Well, we'll come back to it. We'll come back to it shortly. Okay.